Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus. From the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus, the key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome back to Backchat. If the Nature podcast is a trusty old textbook, then Backchat is the notes I scrawled on the back of an envelope during a second year stats lecture. This month we're tackling scientific data, scientific papers, and religion. I'm Adam Levy, and joining me in the studio is Richard Van Norden.
Hello, I'm Nature's European Bureau Chief out of London.
On the line from Munich is Alison Abbott.
Hi, I write for Nature from Munich.
And phoning in from Shanghai is David Cyrinowski.
Hello, I'm Nature's Asia-Pacific correspondent based in Shanghai.
We'll be starting off gently with the light topic of science and religion. The current Pope, Pope Francis, is making efforts to connect with science and scientists alike. Given the historically tempestuous relationship between science and religion, how should scientists respond? We'll also be taking a look at a crackdown on fake data in China. We all want better data, but is the threat of the death penalty the way to achieve it? Plus, we'll take a look at a paper that's been retracted twice. How much can and should scientific publishing learn from retractions like these? First this month, religion, or to be more precise, Catholicism. Alison, this Pope has set himself apart in many ways, and his engagement with science is just one of them.
Yes, that's right. Pope Francis became Pope in 2013, and he has noticeably been more receptive to scientists.
What examples are there of this engagement?
So last week, there was a historic meeting of the Pope with about 1,000 members of the Huntington's disease community around the world. And this is what set me on my train of thought about it. I wrote a leader highlighting a couple of these examples. The initiative came from two scientists who work in Huntington's disease and had been aware that they were using research material from Huntington's patients. And so these scientists started to think about what they could do for these people as some sort of thank you. And since they'd been working with these rather large communities based in South America, where Catholicism is extremely widespread, they thought that they'd contact the Pope and ask if he would give them an audience. And perhaps surprisingly, the whole thing took off and it was a huge affair that took place last week.
And this isn't the only discipline in which there's been increased interaction between the Pope and scientists. I suppose climate change is another big one, right?
Climate change is another big one. And I think the initial encouragement actually came from 2 years ago when the Pope wrote this encyclical, which is sort of like a statement to his staff, that is the cardinals and others who interact with their parishes, on how they should respond to current issues of the day. But it very much gives the impression that accepting climate change is man-made and something that has to change is fundamental to the Pope's policy. His views on contraception have become actively ambiguous. And this was something that was very interesting to confront for the Huntington's patients last week, because they have no cure, but you can avoid the disease if the Pope allows you to use contraception or to do pre-implantation testing before having a child. So this paints a picture of quite a huge leap forward for the Catholic Church reaching out to scientists.
The pre-implantation diagnosis, is that something that the Pope has a position on?
Yes, you're not allowed to interfere with the human embryo in any form whatsoever, so pre-implantation diagnosis would not be acceptable. It's in the way that contraception is, at least theoretically, not acceptable.
Given that there are, of course, inevitably still some gaps between the church's positions and certain positions of researchers, is this something that just concerns scientists who are Catholic or who live in Catholic countries? Or, David, should scientists in China care that the Pope is more engaged in science?
I don't think that there are probably many people in China that are following that. But the scientists who are actually involved in developing the related technologies probably would care in the long run. You know, it will come to them eventually that there is more acceptance of these technologies in the West, and you know that what the Pope says is part of that.
For scientists who aren't religious, is this mostly just good news because the church has such a wide reach?
I think so. And the church does have some influence in the climate debate, I think, because you know, if you can quote the Pope as endorsing a position which President Trump might not endorse, for example, this is a good counterbalance.
Yeah, we're in a slightly strange position right now of hoping that the Pope will convince a politician, the leader of the free world, that climate change is a real thing and a real threat.
Yes, pretty bizarre stuff, isn't it?
Alison, you wrote an editorial, I think, a few years ago about the Vatican pushing for adult stem cells to be used in treatments because of their antipathy to embryonic stem cells, and saying that that was a shame because they were so keen to embrace the potential of adult stem cells that they were pushing it way beyond the state of knowledge about their use in treatments. So it's sometimes it's not always a good that the Pope and the Vatican are interested in science if they're pushing things that aren't ready.
No, absolutely. And I think the language I used was a little bit stronger than it's a shame. This was just a few weeks, actually, after the White Smoke announced the selection of Pope Francis. So it was organised under Pope Benedict. And it was totally misguided meeting that they had there where this became a platform for some of these companies, you know, that promote adult stem cell transfer from your own blood cells or bone marrow cells or even fat cells that's going to miraculously cure every disease that you have. And these companies operate in a very unethical space. They offer expensive therapy that is not without risk and is almost certainly without value in places where it's allowed, which are fewer and fewer in the world now. But nonetheless, the Vatican, in its mission to have an alternative to human embryonic stem cells, allowed this to happen. I think the Vatican is becoming a little bit more sophisticated than this now and is unlikely to be taken in or to collude with such clearly bad science.
Well, now that we've settled this tricky topic, let's move on to our second and turn to China. Now, China is getting serious about stopping fake data. What's the situation, David? What's going on?
Well, this is specifically about fake data in drug applications. So when people are applying to get a drug approved so that they can sell it on the market, they submit their data to the China version of the Food and Drug Administration. The problem is that they've had a backlog of applications, and most of it is junk that should never be approved. And the Chinese government basically got fed up with trying to deal with this and sort through all this junk. And so basically they've come down and said that they are going to prosecute people who submit fake data for these drug approvals.
Surely fake data was already something that was at least frowned upon, maybe illegal?
Well, definitely frowned upon, but not illegal. So there were, if you made a counterfeit drug and you sold it on the market in China, you could get in trouble for that. But if you submitted a drug for approval and you used fake data in that submission, if you got it through the approval process, then you're okay to sell it. Now, the very act of submitting fake data is a crime and punishable by years in prison and even by death.
Are there any other examples, I suppose, out there in China or elsewhere of such extreme punishment for dodgy research?
dodgy research, I think, still isn't really prosecuted in most places. But this is specifically for stuff that's submitted to the drug agency. And in that sense, there are. Like in the U.S., there are famous cases of people that work at contract research organizations, and these are places that are basically paid to give candidate drugs to people. And there are a lot of reasons you're not supposed to give to people. But to get their numbers up, some of the people running these trials would ignore the exclusions. So even if you're not supposed to have smokers in your clinical trial, they would include them. So there are cases that, in the U.S., the guy being put in jail for 15 years who basically just ignored all of these reasons that he wasn't supposed to be putting people in the trial. So there are, you know, prison terms given to people for doing this.
Do we have any indication, David, of how common made-up data in clinical trials is in China? Your story talked about some earlier crackdowns where an extraordinary percentage of applications were then withdrawn. It was something like 80%, wasn't it, from your story?
Yeah, so last year the government came out and said basically if any of the applications that you currently have pending with us turn out to have bad data in them, we are going to blacklist you from applying in the future. And like you said, 80% of the people retracted their applications. It doesn't mean all of these are fraudulent. It could just mean that they were sloppy or they didn't have confidence in them for whatever reason.
I thought this was the most extraordinary story. I mean, the most extraordinary thing, of course, is the execution for, you know, if you cheat in your application, you could actually be executed.
First of all, this story is, I mean, this idea that you could have executions, I think a lot of people, their first instinct is, no, there's no way you could execute for someone for just putting in bad data. But then you think about it, and you know, there are cases where someone submits fake data and then people die from that. And that's happened in China. And in fact, it happened, 10 years ago, there was a former FDA, the head of the FDA, who was executed in China because he had been accepting bribes to approve drugs that eventually killed people. So, you know, I think we'll probably see some of that this time around too, where all of a sudden you have someone who is given a very harsh penalty, and they'll hope that that is going to be something that people pay attention to.
I have to say that it's not just Chinese clinical trials that are in doubt right now. There's some doubts about international clinical trials that are run across many different countries. And there was a paper out, I think, in the NEJM quite recently that followed up this big trial where there was some doubt about the data from the arms of the trial from Russia and Georgia. And there's big questions now being raised about whether these international trials, every arm of the trial, the data can be trusted. So it's not just China where there might be concerns.
Is there a more organic way of science self-correcting, I suppose, in cases like this? I mean, things like replication studies, can they handle some of this before we get, I suppose, courts involved?
I guess replication is extremely expensive. How much does each clinical trial cost? I mean, we're talking about tens and tens, sometimes even hundreds of millions of euros or dollars to conduct a big phase three clinical trial. So, I mean, you can't do it at a drop of a hat.
And of course, we're seeing the movement even in the States and Europe just to get companies to publish their darn trial results is hard enough.
Yeah.
And just seeing a bit of movement on that with various authorities saying you must publish your results. You've got to feel that the pharma industry has a long way to go to gain trust.
There's this idea that science is self-correcting, and so there's a bit of a lax attitude towards it, that science is going to work its way out. If it's not true, scientists will find that it's not true. And I think that it's a bit naive, and I think it does leave open, you know, science journals to bad publications, and leaves open drug approval agencies to bad applications. So I think there is something that we could do with a bit of more oversight on this.
Speaking of dodgy research practices, let's turn to our third and final topic of the month, which is retractions. Now, Richard, there's been a re-retraction recently, right?
This re-retraction caught my eye from Retraction Watch, the website that tracks retractions. And it's a study that suggested that vaccines raise the risk of autism. It's not very good science. It's based on anonymous online questionnaires from the mums of vaccinated or unvaccinated children, just asking them about their kids' allergies or neurodevelopmental disorders. There's no controls here for whether the two groups of children had different numbers of visits to doctors. There's no real knowledge of who these mums are. One of the authors is a chiropractor. It's not even clear that this study was done. So, I mean, no scientist would say that this was a good paper, but it appeared in a journal called Frontiers in Public Health in November 2016. There was an immediate protests on Twitter about it, and it was retracted. The journal said that, in fact, it had never actually published the paper. It had just sort of accepted it and put it online provisionally. And then it appeared again in another journal, Journal of Translational Science, under a different title, but the same paper. And Retraction Watch reported that that's been retracted too. So, what does this episode tell us about science publishing? I mean, I think that there are journals that don't deserve the name journals that are outright predatory, just accepting anything, taking money for it. And so I suppose this double retraction is just a very extreme example of that. But I'm pleased to say that we're living in a golden age of retractions, and we should be very, very pleased about that. Because before the turn of this millennium, scientists were seeing about 30 retractions a year. We seem to be in an age of utterly clean literature. You know, what rubbish that was. And now we're seeing retractions risen about 20-fold, about 600 a year now, which sounds like a lot. It's certainly rising a lot faster than the number of papers published, but it's still only 0.04% of the, you know, 2 million of English language papers published each year. So people look at that and they're still sort of reassured that it's still a small number. But actually, you know, we know that retraction should be higher. We know that surveys in which scientists self-report their misconduct, that they admit to the misconduct, typically they self-admit to fabricating or falsifying data at rates that, you know, approach kind of 1%, 2%. But, you know, for a profession, that's pretty good. So it's ridiculous that retractions are so few. There should be thousands of retractions each year. I think many people opine, and they may be right, that today's kind of ultra-competitive, publish or perish, Photoshop-savvy, tenure-obsessed, blockbuster drug-focused scientific culture is leading to a rise in fraud. And that may be true, but I don't think that the rising retractions data really tells you very much about that. I think it's more a sort of social and political phenomenon that we are seeing more retractions from journals. And I think that's to do with the greater public pressure and the greater visibility you can now have. Everything is online. Twitter can be used to call out dodgy data. So I sort of think that it's great that we're seeing more and more retractions, and we should see more.
So isn't it ideal that we should see zero in an ideal world where no one is publishing papers that should be retracted in the first place?
Well, I don't think you can ever get zero, because there will always be people who cut corners. And I don't think the peer review will ever be able to catch all these cut corners. So I don't know what the natural number should be, but I'm pretty sure it's too low.
But what's surprising to me about this is that when I submitted my thesis, for example, it went through anti-plagiarism software that automatically checked that I hadn't copied anything from elsewhere or just replicated something from elsewhere. I would have thought that these journals would have at least this kind of automatic software.
Yes, it's ludicrous. And most journals do use this kind of software. And, you know, the fact that this got published again just tells you that this is as much a journal as a spam email is a legitimate communication. It's just a thing with a website. Weirdly, you know, these not really journals are the least likely to retract usually, because they just don't care. And you actually see more retractions in the mid-range and higher journals. Nature and Science, for example, have quite a lot of retractions relative to the number of papers they publish. And that's probably partly to do with the fact that perhaps people cut corners to get into these journals, but also these journals are publishing absolute cutting-edge, unknown, venturing into new science, not routine science that confirms whether the parameters are already known. So there's probably going to be more retractions there as well. But also, these journals are more likely to retract because they need to maintain their reputation whereas the crappy journals at the bottom of the pile don't have a reputation to maintain. They just need to make money.
I've done a lot of stories on scientific misconduct, and it's just such a huge, slow and expensive process to get something retracted when you're dealing with scientists and multi-author papers that just simply don't want to accept this. It can take years. You have the editors don't want to retract it because, you know, maybe they accepted it in the first place. It's embarrassing. You know, if you tell me that there's only a few hundred retractions a year, I would think, that many? How did they manage to achieve that?
There's very little motivation for retracting. I mean, from the journal's perspective, from the author's perspective, it's a very long and drawn out process. And I think that most scientists trust their instincts, and I think they're probably right. They can go through, look at a paper, decide that it's not worth considering because they think it's either fraudulent or because it's just sloppy and not reproducible, and then they'll just ignore it. And I think that's how scientists usually deal with this, is they just ignore papers.
A lot of papers turn out to be wrong for various reasons. What leads, in theory at least, a paper to being retracted? Is it explicitly if it's sloppy or actively fraudulent?
Well, it should be that you can't rely on the findings of the paper. But in practice, as you say, that's not true. I mean, just to take a very famous paper, Svante Paabo's 1985 paper, where he cloned nuclear DNA from an ancient mummy that appeared in Nature. We realize now that it's wrong. There was contamination. But yeah, no one's asking for it to be retracted. DNA extraction techniques have moved on. The old methods aren't relevant, and it just sits there, and essentially everything in it is wrong, but whatever. You know, Paabo is rightly a leader now in the extraction of ancient DNA. So it seems that the bar is, if the paper is so flawed that it's causing real problems, which could be unfair self-promotion or career enhancement for somebody, wasting time and money because other labs are trying to build on it and they're not sure if it's true or not. So there has to be a kind of live real life problem, and once the water's passed under the bridge, most scientists will just let it go.
It just reminded me of a story that I was writing about earlier, which was counterfeit biological reagents to be used in experiments in China, and one of the authors of a paper who ended up using one of these counterfeit reagents and did a study and thought, well, I have these great results, published the paper, and then later found out that it was a counterfeit reagent he was using, and so he completely lost faith in his own results. He decided not to retract. Instead, he wrote to the editor of the journal and said, "Hey, no one should trust these data. This is what happened." And so, I guess there's a sense among scientists where if there is already an indication that a paper has lost its reliability, you don't have to retract it. It's already dead.
But the paper's still there. If I stumbled upon it, not knowing this context, I might think it's trustworthy.
If you're not a scientist in the field, it's unlikely that you're going to stumble upon these papers. So the people who actually come across these papers are people who are probably already invested in the field and probably know. I'm not saying that they, you know, these papers shouldn't be retracted, but the economics of it, you know, who's going to go through and actually do this filtering? I think scientists kind of trust themselves to do it.
You have to think of students who are trying to learn science and will come across this if they're investigating a particular field. I think it's not completely true to say that those that come across it will be scientists who know better anyway.
It seems to me the problem comes when the specialist field gets exposed to the outside, whether that be journalists, students, scientists from another field, and they don't have any flags or signals, as you were saying, Alison, to alert them to problems. That's when you need retractions as that clear signal to everybody else.
That's all we have time for this back chat. Enjoy it until it is retracted. Thank you to David Cyrinowski, Alison Abbott and Richard Van Norden. For all the latest science news, nature.com/news is the place to go. And we'd love to know what you think of the podcast. Drop us an email, podcast@nature.com, a tweet @naturepodcast, or feel free to vent in the form of a review on iTunes accompanied by a handful of stars. I'm Adam Levy. Thanks for listening.
Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus, From the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus, the key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.